Madeline Ostrander is a freelance journalist based in Seattle, Washington, who focuses on writing about the environment, energy, and science. In her recent article in the University of Minnesota's environmental journal, ENSEA, entitled On the Thawing Tundra, Researchers Race to Understand Black Carbon's Climate Impact, we were intrigued. We're fortunate now to have Madeline on the phone to tell us about her story that took her to the Arctic, Alaska, and was supported by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Madeline Ostrander.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for making time for us, Madeline. It looks like you had quite an adventure a year or so ago up to the most northern town in America. Tell us about your travels to the Arctic Circle.
Sure. Well, I went from Seattle up to what was then called Barrow, and it's recently changed its name to Utqiagvik, a reflection of, you know, its heritage, the Inupiat people who live there. Barrow is an interesting town. It's a town where there's a thriving culture of Inupiat people who still are involved in living off the land and the hunting and whaling. There's also a lot of oil industry presence in Utqiagvik, and then there's a lot of scientific research that happens there, and a certain amount of old military facilities there as well. And I went up there and I spent some time with a couple of scientists who were studying air quality there using very sophisticated equipment, but in a pretty rugged setting. They had this tiny little lab perched out on the tundra with some pretty expensive and pretty unique equipment inside of it. And they would go out there every day and try to measure the air particles that were drifting up into the Arctic.
Yes, your description was really put me in the scene where we've got maybe a $5,000 shack with hundreds of thousand dollars worth of scientific equipment. And perched right on the tundra, right on the edge of the Arctic Circle. And what were they studying? What is the quest of this research?
Yeah, so it was two researchers were leading it, two women, one from Baylor University and one from the University of Michigan. Initially, they had come up there partly because the Royal Dutch Shell was drilling some exploratory wells off of the Arctic coast there, and they wanted to see if they could detect a signal from those wells. But then Royal Dutch Shell decided to pull out, and they shifted some of their research to just focusing more generally on what was happening with these air particles that were coming into the Arctic. Because, of course, that's not the only development that's happening in the Arctic. There's a whole lot of new things that are coming into that region, including there's a huge increase in shipping. There are new cruise ships that are coming into the Arctic. Prudhoe Bay is still the third largest oil field in the United States, and there's still a ton of industry up there turning out, you know, lots of oil and gas. And so they wanted to see what kinds of impacts that kind of development was happening in the Arctic, because the Arctic is an unusual sort of environment, and there's certain kinds of pollutants, and in particular what my article focused on was a pollutant called black carbon, that have a different sort of impact when they land in the Arctic than they might in some other part of the world.
Yes, black carbon, a.k.a. soot. Could you describe that for our listeners? What is black carbon?
Soot is sort of, a good visual characterization of it. You could think of it almost as like that stuff that you sweep up in the bottom of your fireplace, in a sense. But it's sort of like dark dust, and it's less than a 30th or less of the width of a human hair, and it comes from burning of two kinds of things, either fossil fuels or wildfires. And it can affect the Arctic in two ways. One is that when it becomes airborne, it can drift large distances. And so black carbon can either be produced in the Arctic and can sort of stay there, or it can be produced in another part of the world and drift into the Arctic. And when it's in the air, it absorbs heat from sunlight and then it radiates it back into the atmosphere. So it contributes to the warming of the planet. It can also land on ice and snow. And of course, there's a lot of ice and snow in the Arctic. And when it does that, it's kind of like, heard it described as being like putting on a black sweater. Like, it just makes those surfaces warmer, so it contributes to their melting and thawing that way. And it's shorter lived than some other pollutants that contribute to climate change, so it stays in the atmosphere for a period of days to weeks, which means that anything we do to try to address or rein in black carbon could have a fairly quick impact on the planet, which is one of the hopeful things about it.
Yes, your title certainly calls to the question, you know, where It is researchers racing to understand black carbon's impact on climate change. What type of understanding are we racing for? What, you know, unanswered questions, I think, is something you raised in the article. What are those unanswered questions?
A lot of our understanding of how black carbon works in the global atmosphere is based on estimates from measurements taken in the lab, partly because it's just difficult to get up to the Arctic to take these kinds of measurements. So, you know, if you have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment into a little box on the tundra, that's a big investment of both time and energy. And yet, there's a lot of things that you can measure and understand on the ground in the real world that you wouldn't be able to understand in a lab. So, for instance, these researchers that I was talking about in Barrow learned, among other things, that the emissions from Prudhoe Bay, from the oil drilling there, are contributing a lot more black carbon to the system up in the North American Arctic than they previously thought, which calls into question a lot of other things about how development, further development in the Arctic might affect that region. For instance, Alaska is looking at developing this pretty substantial new natural gas project in the Arctic to export LNG. Russia has just started exporting LNG from big new natural gas project in the Arctic. And there's a lot of interest in doing a lot of kinds of development in the Arctic because it's becoming more accessible because of climate change. Because it's getting warmer, there's less ice, so it's easier to get up there. And then, you know, that opens the region up to activities that unfortunately could make it even warmer and contribute to the problem of climate change even more. So it's unfortunately kind of a little bit of a vicious cycle at the moment.
So it sounds like a tracing of its origin, soot's sources, and how it ends up in the Arctic is certainly on the docket for the researchers.
Mm-hmm.
What makes black carbon so challenging to study? Is it its unique composition and how you say it can change over time and heat and wind and, you know, driven? I definitely got the sense that there was an emphasis on the local production being more harmful if it's coming from nearby versus hundreds or millions or thousands of miles away.
Right.
Yeah. What are the sources exactly that we know of?
There's a lot of sources, and they come from around the world. Some of them are, for instance, from Southeast Asia. Some of the wood stoves and cook stoves that people use in those countries, but not just in those countries. I mean, also there are people using wood stoves in the Arctic, but some of those can drift northward. It depends a lot on where global air currents are moving, and you know, the global atmosphere is a pretty complex system, of course. So.
Sure.
Some sources of black carbon are more likely to drift into the Arctic than others.
And are
I
was going to ask, are the scientists able to distinguish that in their carbon dating, for example, the source of the carbon?
Yeah, they are. So that was one of the cool things about this lab that I visited. They had this piece of equipment. Its official name was, it's officially a mass spectrometer, a kind of mass spectrometer, but it's a very sophisticated one. The researcher that I was speaking with there, his name is Matt Gunge, he had nicknamed the piece of equipment Maverick out of Tom Cruise's character from the movie Top Gun. And it had this system of lasers so that the particle would float into the equipment and then you would get zapped with the laser. And the researcher described it to me as being kind of like the Death Star, where it would sort of blow up the particle. But what it actually did is it would look for how the particle would respond to that kind of being blasted with a laser. And how it responded would give the researchers a kind of signature. And then they could identify very precisely where it came from based on, you know, what kinds of other particles were sort of attaching themselves to it and what different kinds of molecules were in there. So they could say this particle came from a natural gas plant versus this particle came from a ship versus this is just a bit of salt from the ocean that drifted here.
Wow.
And that allowed them to get very precise ideas about what was really happening in the Arctic and where different particles were coming from. There is a lot of complexity because there's so many different sources and they can drift in from so many different places. So getting a real understanding of what are the different sources of what's contributing the most here will tell first researchers and then policymakers, you know, what do we need to do to get a handle on this problem? I mean, the hopeful thing is that there was one study that suggested that cutting back on black carbon could cut the warming of the planet by as much as, say, a quarter of a degree Celsius, which is a lot on a global scale. You know, we talk about, like, trying to rein in carbon dioxide or trying to rein in warming by 2 degrees Celsius overall. So when you're talking about just this set of simple steps that could cut warming by a quarter of a degree, that's pretty substantial.
Indeed. Indeed. We're speaking with Madeline Ostrander. She's a freelance journalist based in Seattle, Washington. She's got a fascinating article in ENSEA, the University of Minnesota's environmental journal, ENSEA. It's entitled, On the Thawing Tundra, Researchers Race to Understand Black Carbon's Climate Impact. Madeline was fortunate enough to visit the Arctic Circle and one of these research stations, analyzing the air and discovering the source of soot as it leads to the warming of the Arctic. And you refer to the Arctic getting too hot as being akin to setting off a giant Rube Goldberg machine. Could you please explain this concept?
Sure. Well, I was looking for a metaphor to explain to people how the Arctic is connected to the rest of us, because really, you know, as remote as the Arctic is, it has a big influence on the lives of everyone else in the world. And that's partly because the Arctic is sort of like, and now I'm going to mix metaphors, but let's say it's the Earth's air conditioner, kind of. Arctic ice is very reflective, and when sunlight hits the planet, it reflects some of that heat and energy back out, and so it's kind of a buffer against global warming. But as the Arctic warms and thaws, that ice starts to melt, and instead of ice, you have ocean water, and ocean water absorbs heat instead of reflecting it back out. Also, the permafrost is a store of a lot of methane, which is another powerful contributor to global warming. And so when you start thawing the permafrost in the Arctic, you start to get some big releases of methane into the atmosphere, which makes the problem of climate change worse. So there's a lot of reasons why we should be concerned about the Arctic and see it as, you know, connected to everything that's happening in the rest of the planet.
Well, I saw a little good news in your article in terms of the, you know, international awareness of black carbon and its ability to be controlled. It seems to be perhaps a lower hanging fruit than some of these CO2 goals and, you know, international climate change committees that are focusing both on CO2 emissions and black carbon emissions. Is it true that perhaps black carbon might be the easier of the two to get a handle on?
Yeah. Black carbon can be addressed through some fairly straightforward technological steps in a lot of cases. And it's something that seems to be in some ways less controversial than other kinds of measures to address climate change. Finland actually just took over running the Arctic Council, which is kind of like the United Nations of the Arctic in a sense. It's a group of Arctic nations that get together and make agreements. And they already have several agreements try to deal with black carbon, including one that all of them, including the United States, agreed on in 2017, which was to try to cut black carbon by 25% to 33% by 2025. But this past week, the ambassador to the Arctic Council from Finland said it was his personal goal and priority to take on black carbon. And there's lots of ways then that could be done, and they're kind of win-wins. For instance, I mentioned these wood stoves and cook stoves that contribute to black carbon both in Asia when they drift northwards and also in northern latitudes. There's a lot of health problems that people have to deal with because of cook stoves that are not very well designed. They can contribute to carbon monoxide poisoning and other kinds of respiratory problems. And so if you instead give people cleaner burning stoves and better technology, their health improves, and also it reins in this black carbon problem. So that's a win-win. In the United States, a lot of the work that we've done here to try to cut diesel pollution has also helped cut back on black carbon emissions here. The International Maritime Organization is pushing all shipping that goes through the Arctic to stop using heavy fuel oil, which produces a lot of black carbon, and switch to cleaner burning fuels. And as I said, you know, all of these natural gas projects could do things, take steps to capture methane instead of burning it off, which also produces a lot of black carbon. So there's pretty straightforward steps and technologies that could deal with this. And some of the scientists I've talked to have said that this could buy us time to deal with other kinds of climate change pollution because it's straightforward to address. It has a pretty quick, noticeable impact on the planet and on the Arctic. And, you know, it could help rein in warming while we're kind of coming up with other solutions.
Yes, and it sounds like time is of the essence. You had shared some observations of the researchers who are in the Arctic. What is happening on the ground up there?
Carrie Pratt from the University of Michigan just talked about how within the few years that she had gone up there, she had seen a major change in Arctic sea ice. Pretty much anyone who lives in the Arctic who spent time in the Arctic can talk to you about how there's just been an extreme sort of crazy amounts of warming in the Arctic, ice retreat, which is making the storms worse. Permafrost is getting destabilized, which is making like houses tilt, like their foundations are going off kilter up there. There's all sorts of very strange and kind of troubling impacts happening in the Arctic very quickly. The Arctic is warming at least twice as fast as the rest of the planet. It's pretty important to try to address these things pretty quickly. And I think the good news about black carbon is that that's actually possible.
You know, it is on behalf of the awareness. Certainly the, you know, research is going to be ongoing, but your bringing attention to this is very important, Madeline. So we appreciate this and your advocacy and your writing will continue. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm continuing to write about climate change and agriculture and, you know, different kinds of issues related to, particularly related to adaptation and how we sort of get our communities ready for the kinds of impacts that we're all seeing, not just in the Arctic, but, you know, even here.
True.
Here in the West, we're dealing with things like wildfires. And so,
longer if, but when.
Right.
Well, continue the good work, Madeline, and thank you for your time here at the Roadhouse. And for folks that are interested, more information can be found online with you. I see you have a nice website, madelineostrander.net. We'll, of course, include that link with this interview. Any other last-minute advice you'd like to give or any sort of resources for our listeners?
As I said, there was a big meeting on the Arctic in Seattle this last week, and I think the main message was, you know, as the Arctic goes, so goes the world, or like the Arctic is part of all of our collective heritage, so I think it's worth paying attention to and being concerned about what happens up there.
Well said. Madeline Ostrander, thank you, and continue with your good writing.
Thank you so much.